The following podcast was recorded on the 15th of September 2009 and was scheduled to be released on the following day. However, during this period, new information has come to light regarding the investigation of Renault amid allegations of race fixing. In a statement issued today, the French manufacturer confirmed that its managing director, Flavio Briatore, and also its executive director of engineering, Pat Simmons, had left the team. The statement also confirmed that Renault would not be contesting the FIA's charges regarding the 2008 Singapore Grand Prix. Therefore, any opinions given in this podcast were made before this information came to light and may no longer be an accurate description of events. Hello there, thank you for joining us on the third ever Grand Prix cast brought to you by Formula1.net. Always first for the discussion and the news. Well, we've had quite a cracking Italian Grand Prix last weekend. I hope you watched it and I hope you enjoyed it. And within the next 30 minutes or so, we're going to review the best bits of the whole weekend at Monza and add in a few of our views and bring you up to date with some of the news which has broken since the Grand Prix. As ever, I'm joined by a panel, but we've streamlined the cover of our panel down this week, and we've got with us our two regulars, as always, Gaz and Jack. Good evening, gentlemen. How are things?
Good evening.
I am well.
It sounded a little bit hoarse there, but hello. Right, so I think we'll start off by looking at Monza as a whole, and we'll review the race. And let's go back to the start of the weekend, and certainly some weather reports were saying that rain was on its way, but it never came. So we headed into qualifying, and what a qualifying session we had. Was there any surprises in qualifying? Did anyone think that anyone stood out?
Sutil, definitely. I mean, come on, that was great. Seeing him up first and he still closed up there after Spa. Shame we didn't get, you know, the pole, but it was pretty good for his fuel load dice.
I was quite surprised to see Kovalainen on fuel corrected pole. I didn't think he would. I thought the Kers cars would kind of be in the mix if Kers was the thing to have, and it was shown after the practice sessions that it was going to be an advantage. But I didn't, you know, you'd expect Lewis rather than Heikki.
One issue which happened in qualifying, in the first sector of qualifying actually, was Sebastian Buemi's lap being blocked by Lewis Hamilton. And, you know, obviously Lewis didn't see Buemi coming out of the track. Well, he maybe he did, but that's up for question. But do you feel that Hamilton should have got a penalty? Now, I realise that Buemi was never going to get off the back row of the grid, but rules are rules, and should they be adhered to in all situations?
Not really. I mean, it was an error, you know, but I think if you start penalising drivers, especially, you know, when they've gotten pole, it just starts to be like, you know, the result being altered after the event's taking place all the time. I mean, I think they let it go, and it was the right decision. You know, you can't penalise every single slip up. You know, you've got to have some leeway.
I think Toro Rosso did the right thing. I mean, I think if they'd have gone to the stewards and asked them to look at it, then Hamilton would have been given a penalty, because it did hold him up. But Toro Rosso weren't going to gain anything from it. There was no point in having any bad blood with McLaren. And obviously Lewis didn't intend to do it. It was just a mistake. So I think the right result emerged from the situation.
Yes, certainly. I tell you, we spoke about Sutil, who, if he hadn't made a mistake in sector two of his final lap, would have surely been on pole. But Tony Luzzi also had an amazing start to his weekend. He looked fast in practice, and he was able to drag his Force India into the final sector of qualifying, and he went onto the grid in seventh position with a very reasonable fuel load. How would you rate Luzzi's weekend in comparison with Fisichella, who struggled in the Ferrari?
Well, I mean, I did expect Giannotto to be better, You know, because having just stepped out of an F1 car racing around the track, you know, racing the current series. But I mean, you can say, well, he did have curse to deal with, and I don't know how complicated that is. And furthermore, Eliotti would have been in, would have been doing pretty more probably straight line tests, so probably a bit more use of the car than Yano would have been to the Ferrari. So I did expect, him to better. I didn't expect him to have beaten Kimi. But I, you know, I thought perhaps he'll get like, you know, I'd expect Q3, I suppose. I don't know, especially after Spa, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the moment it's kind of a strange situation where we are talking about Force India that's fundamentally faster than the Ferrari. Without the Kers, the Force India would have beaten Ferrari in Spa, and I think it would have been the faster car at Monza if Kers wasn't around. But yeah, I did expect Fisichella to be closer to Räikkönen, and I didn't expect him to be perhaps not on the same row, but you know, in the same session, certainly he should have made it to Q3. But I mean, I'm really happy for Liuzzi, because I've always thought he wasn't given enough of a shot in Formula One, considering how good he was in F3000, and it's good to see him on top of the car.
I would agree with you. He won something like 7 out of 10 in his 2004 Formula 3000 championship year. He won 7 out of 10 races, So the man had an impeccable record. I think what hampered him and his Formula 1 career was being drafted in such fashion as he was with Red Bull, where he was only in for a certain number of races, you know, and he would alternate with Christian Klien. And that was no way to try and get a grasp of the sport, and it was certainly no way to try and make an impact. So I'm glad he's finally got this chance with Force India, because he always was a fast driver in my books. He wasn't helped by the internal politics which plagued Toro Rosso, and he was unfairly, in my opinion, ejected from that seat. So I'm glad that he's got a job, and hopefully into 2010, Vijay Mallya has certainly sounded him out. So things are looking up for Force India. And let's move on to the race now. And certainly at the start of the race, everybody was mentioning the name Heikki Kovalainen. He certainly looked in a fantastic position. As you've already mentioned, Jack, his fuel load was very, very substantial, and surely he was favourite to win the race. What do you think went wrong for Heikki Kovalainen? And do you think now that after such a lacklustre performance, his career with McLaren is finished?
He went backwards, didn't he? McLaren said that he was on the wrong tyres, but, I mean, he would have had to race those tyres anyway. And, you know, Lewis didn't seem to struggle on them as much. So, I mean, obviously the fuel was different, but I just think really a big, real big letdown. He gave up to Button too easily. And he started going for Rubens right at the start, you know, he was right behind Rubens. But then he made a small mistake when he moved alongside, allowing Jensen to get the run up on him. And you know, once Jensen at the side of him, he just gave up. And he just went further back the grid then. And it's just like, I was just, you know, watching it and thinking, God, heck, you know, do something. But that was it, you know, he'd given up. You know, although he's got more points than Lewis, fine. But I think if he having not completed the first two races of the season, and just been lackluster compared to Lewis. I mean, I know the car's not been great, but been, you know, not nearly as good as Lewis in 90% of the races this season. I think it's McLaren. You know, been a top flight team. You know, they don't need to. Struggle to find drivers, you know, that I want to join their team. So I think Heikki's really going to struggle to keep a seat for next season.
I mean, when the qualifying weights were unveiled, I never really fancied Heikki for the win anyway, because he had a lot of places to make up in what was a fairly short run down to the first corner. If Kers is going to help him make some positions, and he was always going to be vulnerable with his fuel load. From people behind him who maybe were going to be faster in the first couple of laps in the race. And I think what was interesting, we saw this a couple of times, is that the new curbs at the chicane seemed to play a role in the amount of overtaking manoeuvres, because people couldn't be as aggressive in getting back online once they'd conceded a place. They couldn't scramble across the curbs to minimise the damage. They ended up losing more places as a result of getting involved in manoeuvres in those in between those tall curbs. I think that contributed to Hickey's rapid slip down the order. But I mean, yeah, for a guy who was so good at racing through the pack in GP2, I can't understand why he just hasn't shown any of that in Formula One to date.
Well, there's two important points that you've made there, Jack. I'll go back to the curbs issue in a few minutes, but certainly, I think you're right. I think high kick over line, and the T-Man himself has known this all year, that he has had issues with the new car and adapting to the new rules and the new regulations and the way the car handles. And, you know, from talking to McLaren and the phone-ins have been involved, they've certainly given him all the opportunities they could, and they've always been there for the driver, but surely their patience is starting to get frayed a little bit. I mean, heck, he was all on to have a very strong Valencia weekend as well, and although, you know, McLaren said up until the final part of the race he had driven fine and it was only their problem with the tyres that had let him down, you know, you've got to start looking towards Nico Rosberg or a number of other drivers that certainly could fill a void, because McLaren might have a competitive car next season, but the problem could be for them that they're not going to be able to challenge for the constructors, because Heikki Kovalainen, and in no way this is offence to Kovalainen, but he's just not consistent enough. I mean, if you look at this year, he has only finished three of the first eight races this year. I mean, a lot of that, okay, well, there was a few technical problems and so forth, but for a man to have that sort of record, even if the car's that bad, you know, troubled times.
Yeah, definitely. Like I say, he got dumped for by Renault pretty quickly, and McLaren took him in, you know, perhaps part of the deal with Alonso, but you'd have thought he'd have relished a chance to be in a top flat car, especially in 2008, but, you know, he looked, you know, positively average compared to Lewis in 2008, when we should have won the Constructors' Championships, really. But, you know, what can you say? If he's not performing in McLaren, he's not going to keep the seat, simple as that.
To go back to what you were saying earlier, Jack, this year the Monza organisers raised the curves in certain corners to try and prevent drivers from, you know, cutting the chicanes and making up time that way. Do you think that was a good idea?
I mean, I agree with anything that makes it more difficult for the drivers anyway, so to give them something else to think about, I thought it was quite good, but I didn't think it was really going to affect things until the first lap of the race, where I noticed that people seemed to be getting caught out of position with people making moves, and it seemed to be more difficult to keep people behind once you'd have to sort of scoot around the outside and stand on the brakes to avoid those curbs. So, you know, if they cause more overtaking, then that's brilliant. We might see a rash of them throughout circuits around the world if it turns out to be a secret formula for overtaking.
I actually had to applaud the FIA on this, because they were very hard on drivers, you know, who wanted or continue to cut the chicane to their own advantage. I mean, I watched the GP2 feature race, which got delayed because of the rain, and it was amazing to see the car sliding about, but that's a different story. But certainly drivers who cut the chicane more than three times were given a drive-through, and I think Karun Shandok was given two drive-through penalties for continuing to cut, so it was very good to see them, the FIA, take action on that. And I think certainly it's a good thing to see, and I hope that a few Formula 1 circuits around the world replicate this, because I think F1 drivers are getting it a little bit too easy in terms of being able to jump the curbs and so forth. Let's move back on to the race, and certainly one of the talking points of the race, in fact the talking point probably, was the fierce battle between Lewis Hamilton and McLaren, against the two Braun drivers, and certainly that turned out to be more about fuel strategies. Lewis Hamilton, of course, was running a two-stop strategy, whereas the Browns are running only one. Could Hamilton have ever won running on a two-stop strategy? Was it ever realistic?
They said perhaps he should put on the other tyres, the primes, when he first started, and that might have helped him a bit, but, I mean, then he still had to run the options on the other another part of the race, but to be fair, really, the McLaren simply wasn't fast enough on the day. We saw how Heikki Kovalainen was fastest, but the second was fuel corrected was Rubens. So it was obvious that they were going to have some pace during the race. So I mean, it was perfect strategy by Mr. Brawn, handed to him. I don't think Lewis could have ever won with that car on that day. I just don't think it had the pace. And he, like I said himself, he was pushing 110-130% just to even catch Jensen. So Jensen's car was genuinely faster than the McLaren at that point.
I think McLaren certainly relied, or were relying, sorry, on Kovalainen again to do more of a job, and maybe the likes of Alonso in another Kers car to be able to get ahead of Barrichello and Button and be able to hold them pack up and allow for Lewis to sprint away. Unfortunately, when Barrichello and Button made such great starts and were able to dispose of Heikki Kovalainen, I think that was it in terms of the strategy. Although Hamilton drove a brilliant race and it was really a gutsy performance, as we've seen at the end of the race, so the two Brawn cars had the pace in the end and were able to get by Lewis Hamilton. But that didn't stop him trying, and of course, on the final lap of the race, he crashed between the two Lesmo curves. Should he have continued to hound down Jenson Button, or should he have just settled for third? He was guaranteed third, there was no threat to him. Should he really have been so ballsy and went for that second position?
Definitely. In F1 at the moment now, I don't think there's enough drivers that do that. You know, they're all too worried about taking what they can get, you know, points wise. So it was fantastic to see him really pushing, and you know, it was getting really exciting towards the end. You know, could he actually overtake Button? I mean, realistically, I didn't think it happened, but then again, it could have been easily Button pushing hard himself, making the same mistake, you know, and then Lewis's claim second, and Button's, you know, 10 points down in Rubens already. But I think if more drivers did that, I think F1 would be a lot more exciting. Just pushed to the absolute limit, and if they crash while doing it, then you know, unlucky. But hats off to them for trying. It was really exciting to watch. He's got nothing to lose, so why not?
From the point of view of should he have gone for it till the last lap? I think absolutely. I think that's as Baz said, it's great for F1 to see someone doing that. But I think if he felt that he could overtake Button in the last lap, I think it was a bit stupid on his part, because there was really no way he was going to be able to make a move. But if he was just attempting to put some pressure on to maybe force Button into a mistake or to spook him, I think that was worth doing, because you know, it's not over till it's over, and I think Hamilton's continued pace could well have spooked Button into a mistake if he'd have got close enough, and that would have been enough for Hamilton to maybe sneak past. So I think, yeah, it was worth trying till the end in the hope that maybe Button made an error.
It was really, you know, brave of Hamilton to continue to push Button into a mistake, but that was his only hope, in my opinion. I don't think he would have been able to even get anywhere near Button to make any sort of move had Button not made a mistake, because certainly, if you look at the remaining corners on the Monza circuit, Ascari wasn't really a place you could get past, and by the time they ran down to the Parabolica, you know, the McLaren Kers system was pretty much at low, so you couldn't really use that. And if you look at the sector times, he wasn't that much faster than Button, so I don't think there was any way Lewis Hamilton, given Jenson Button didn't make a mistake, would have been able to A, get close enough to Button to make a move, or B, certainly get past him. But hats off to him for trying. Will we see more of that next year with the ban and refueling? Do you think more drivers will go for it, knowing that they can't get past in fuel strategy?
Hopefully, yeah, definitely. I'm a bit dubious on this fuel strategy thing, you know, since you brought it up. I mean, it could just be that, you know, without, you know, the real long two stops, you know, like, which is over a minute nearly, we're going to just see drivers simply going to the pits, you know, pull away a big lead, pull the change of tyres, you know, 10 seconds in the pits, be out again, 20 second pit stop max, 30 second pit stop, and the back of the, and then just carry on building a massive lead and just win the, you know, the Grand Prix by laps or minutes, you know, if they've got the good car. Or it could go the other way, so, you know, we see a lot more closer racing because the cars are heavier. I don't really know how it'll work out. So, I mean, if it forces people to push, because they're not going to be able to rely on pit stops, then it's a good thing. But if it just makes the Grand Prix more processional, then it's a bad thing. I guess we'll have to say it works out, you know, come for first race in 2010.
My initial feeling is that, obviously, banning refueling, I feel, will encourage overtaking. I think it will mean that drivers will be forced into taking bigger risks, but it'd be better if they also didn't have to make mandatory tyre changes. Like, Bridgestone aren't exactly my favourite company in the world, but I'm quite irritated that they have sort of demanded that they get this sort of publicity stunt tyre change thing in the rules. It's all basically so that people just talk about the tyres, and so that Bridgestone gets some airtime now there isn't a tyre war. And really, there's no need for them to be changing tyre compounds in the race. They should just be able to do what they want. And I still think that because we've got tyre changes, people are still going to be able to time their pit stops better than other people, and you know, use that to get past people instead of doing it on the track.
Well, I certainly think there's going to be a number of factors which is going to influence Formula One next year, and certainly the new regulations. Yes, there is a few changes, such as, you know, narrower tyres and having to accommodate a larger fuel tank. It's certainly going to have an effect on the order, and hopefully we're going to have even more variation in terms of who's going to win where, who's going to be at the front, etc., etc., etc. But certainly that is a topic that we will come back to later on in future podcasts, because we've still got to focus on this season, and we've still got a championship battle in 2009. And you have to say now, it's a two-horse race between the two Brawn drivers. They had an excellent weekend at Monza, whereas Mark Webber's championship chances surely are over now after, you know, ending up in a collision with Robert Kubica and going into the gravel trap. Where do you place the championship battle now? Who has the advantage?
Well, Jenson Button, obviously, he's got the biggest lead, and it's a four-race championship with him 14 points the lead. I don't know. The only real contender now is, unless him and Rubens make a series of massive mistakes, his Rubens. Vettel is too far behind now, I think, to really, really play into the, you know, contention. So, you know, he's got it really easy, really. I mean, he's in the same car as his teammate and in his main championship contender. So he's just got to, he can even come second to Rubens if Rubens wins every race, and he's still going to be able to have enough points to win.
Did we see a return to form for Jenson Button on Sunday, Jack?
Yeah, I think we did. I think we saw a more relaxed performance from Jenson. He wasn't being overly cautious in his driving the way he seems to have been in the past. He still isn't quite in the groove he was at the start of the season, because I mean, Barrichello was a reasonable way off Button's race pace earlier this season, which led to sort of frustration on Barrichello's part, where he thought his strategy was compromising him, and it was actually just that Button had better race pace. And we haven't actually seen Button return to that sort of level of dominance with respect to his teammate yet, but I think he's on the way there. And you know, even if that form doesn't return by the end of the season, he's still got everything going for him in terms of the championship battle, and it's his to lose.
And at the end of the day, though, it's only a couple of odd races, you know, and his Rubens got a 10-point lead on him, so it's still very, very close yet. Hopefully, it'll come right to the end, and it'll be quite exciting. You know, we don't want to see a couple of Rubens DNFs and Jensen's won it in Brazil or something like that, you know.
I hope you're right. I hope it's not going to be a case where Barrichello runs out of time, because it's refreshing to see the old man. You know, hit form now, and this is his best chance, like Button, to win the championship. And I hope we get a clean fight, and I hope we get an interesting fight, and I hope, as you say, we get one that goes down at the wire. But let's just talk about Red Bull very quickly. They've come out this week, and they've been very, you know, they've criticised Renault, and they've criticised the engine problems that they've had, saying that the championship was already lost before they even got to Monza. How big an effect do you think that the engine failures that plagued Red Bull midway through the season had on their championship? And do you think that's the sole reason, or do you think there was other reasons behind it?
I think it's pretty played into it a bit. But after Mark won in Germany, it looked like a real threat. And not only that, the way he won, by completely dominating you know, the race, even after a penalty and still going out and winning. And I just thought, God, you know, if Mark keeps this up, it could really win. But he's just been incredibly unlucky in the past few races. But not only that, though, the car's just not had the pace, really. That the Brawn just seems more adaptable, and the Brawn doesn't seem to have a bad track. You know, it's been not too good at, you know, like Silverstone, but it's not been terrible. It's still been in the points. Whereas, you know, at Monza, that the Red Bulls just didn't, it wasn't their track at all.
I think Red Bull have had sort of three main problems this season, possibly four even. One was getting left behind with the diffuser thing. They were on the back foot. They were always having to catch up. And then at the point that they started to look like they were beginning to catch up, they had a dilemma that Braun didn't have at the time, which was which driver do we favour, which one is our number one. Vettel and Webber were taking points off each other, whereas Button was the one making all the running for Braun, and that didn't help them catch up. And at the same time, they haven't managed to develop the car as fast as they might like to. I think they've matched Braun's pace in terms of development, but they've been outdeveloped by Ferrari and McLaren, it seems. And then fourthly, the Renault engine has obviously played a part, but I noticed that Renault don't seem to be suffering failures with the regularity that Red Bull seem to, so maybe we should be pointing the finger at Adrian Newey once again.
It might be a coincidence, but when Jeff Willis left Red Bull, it seemed to me that they lost their kind of safety net, their safety check, and as we've seen time and time again, when Adrian Newey has been allowed to go unchecked over his history of designing Formula 1 cars, they've become more and more unreliable. Certainly that appeared to be the case at Williams, and it certainly appeared to be the case at McLaren. And I think that, you know, as you say, Jack, Renault haven't had any problems with the engine, so it could be an installation problem on the Red Bull. Time will tell. But do you think that switching to the Mercedes engine next season is really going to bolster their championship chances? Will it really make that much of a difference?
Are they going to be allowed to switch to a Mercedes? Because I thought Mercedes were only allowed to supply a certain number of teams.
If they get the FIA to agree to it, then they're allowed to. So we could have a number of teams running the Mercedes engine.
I think they also need McLaren's agreement as well. I think Hogg was saying he needs the OK from the FIA, then it's up to McLaren really if they want to go ahead and do it. But to be fair, though, the way it's going, McLaren at the moment, I'll just go ahead and do it anyway.
Well, I mean, at the moment, everyone would jump at the chance to have a Mercedes engine because it looks to be the strongest power plant. But you never know. For next season, it might be different if they unfreeze the engines like they did. And if, you know, they do still do work on the way the engines, you know, produce their power and their fuel economy and things. And I think it might not necessarily be the case that the Mercedes is the class of the field next season, so, I mean, they're just going to have to see.
Well, certainly you have to look at Force India, and you have to look at the fact that McLaren were willing to give them a gearbox and, you know, practically give them help with the rear end, so there was more an incentive, certainly, to sign with Mercedes. I agree with Jack. I hope they do open up the engine kind of war and we get a bit of a competition again between the engine manufacturers. Certainly that would stop any idea of standardised engines, and, you know, I am quite worried about Mercedes having such an influence in so many teams, but I suppose that's another issue for another day, because it's time to move on to Eddie Watch.
Once he was a team owner, now with the BBC, he's sure and he's loud, he hates the curse, his name is Eddie Curse.
Yes, Eddie Jordan. Well, he had another cracking weekend with the BBC. In fact, the BBC had another cracking weekend in general, and there's a lot of issues to talk about. Has anybody got anything they'd like to say about the BBC's coverage this weekend? Did everybody enjoy it?
Apart from the fact that they yet again stopped the qualifying press conference about halfway through to go and watch Murder, She Wrote. No, it was fine. I dislike Murder, She Wrote. I do, but we really have to watch a repeat of an old programme.
Well, I'm more of a diagnosis.
Oh, well, that's good for you, mate.
Yeah, I'm more of a diagnosis murder fan.
I'd rather listen to Kimmy's dulcet tones than watch Murder, She Wrote, so...
Kimmy bending the mic, you know, that happens at every single press conference. And I'm quite annoyed, actually, because if you notice, whenever they do show the press conference, they maybe show two of the drivers, and they cut the third one out. Kimmy had a fantastic third place in the grid in qualifying, and he just got completely blanked out. Is the BBC so corporate nowadays that they don't allow long hair on television?
Yeah, that's exactly it, I think, mate. I think basically they went, there's Kimmy, and just as Kimmy was about to grab the mic and start going, you know, inaudible, cut. Honestly, straight to Middlesbrough Road.
Eddie Jordan was getting into the full swing of Beatles Week. He had John Lennon-style sunlit glasses as he toured up and down the pit lane. And certainly, we've already talked about the Buemi and Hamilton argument. Fireworks yet again when Eddie Jordan tried to explain to DC that he was a team owner and that his decision was more valid than a racing driver. What do you think of that?
I think he's wrong. And I think it would have been funny, you know, while live on air, if DC had just chinned Eddie and, you know, just to see Eddie's reaction then, or just done a complete Felipe Massa and just said, look, Eddie, if you don't shut the thing you could do, obviously, I think that needs to happen before the end of the season, just to see a stunned Eddie Jordan just shut up, you know.
I love how clearly difficult Coulthard finds it to disguise his irritation when Jordan comes out with his like that. Like, Coulthard clearly knew better as a driver, and everyone else seemed to agree on the BBC team that Hamilton had blocked Buemi. And Jordan, who seems to be quite a Hamilton fan, was obviously making a point that DC disagreed with. But I just find it particularly amusing when he does it stood next to DC, and DC just rolls his eyes.
Yeah.
And the picture we're going to post on the website to highlight Eddie Watch, it's a perfect picture, actually, because it features both Eddie and DC, so check the site and you'll see that. Another interesting point about Eddie Jordan recently is how, you know, he's attached himself to Force India being successful. I mean, this is the man who wouldn't let them get into the factory last year. He actually blocked the road off. And then you've seen on the Grand Prix Sunday before the race, him trying to walk into the garage being all friendly with all the mechanics. I mean, how shallow is that? We're on to you, Eddie Jordan. We're on to you.
I'm half expecting to slip up a few times and just start saying, and when Jordan win, I mean Force India, you know, a couple of times during the weekend, because he seems to think they owe him something because he sold the team, well, indirectly, sold someone else's team, and they sold him the team. He had nothing to do with it. It's not Jordan F1, it's a completely different company. Stop trying to steal the limelight.
He seems to come over a bit like sort of a bumbling, slightly senile war veteran who still thinks they're still, like, involved. He seems to think that he still runs Jordan. he's a bit confused. I think someone needs to take him to one side and explain that he's not a team boss anymore.
Yeah.
We could go on and on and on about the BBC, or certainly I could, but there's one thing in particular that really has grated on me, and it's happened again and again and again and again over the past few races this season. Why do they insist on standing outside the garages during the pre-race build-up? We can never hear what they're saying. It irritates me. They said they were going to break away from what ITV represented, or at least build on what ITV represented. Well, all we had in the final year of ITV was Steve Ryder and Mark Blundell standing there, and you weren't able to make out what he was saying, because all you would hear was a Mercedes V8 engine in the background revving up and down. I'm sorry, BBC, it's not good enough. Sort it. You can go and get EJ sources, and you can go and, you know, find somewhere else to sit. I'm sure Red Bull and their energy centre would be perfect. But let's move on for a little rant on the BBC, and let's talk about serious issues again, and the most serious issue to hit Formula One, and it brewed and brewed and brewed, was the Renault race fix saga. Now, new evidence came to light since we last made our podcast, and certainly Renault announced that they were going to charge or take criminal proceedings against the Piquet family for blackmail. It's certainly a messy game, this, and I realise that the truth has to, you know, be found out. We need to try and get such allegations sorted. But was there really any need to have so much information leaked to the public? You know, if this was any other legal proceeding in the world, this sort of conduct would not be tolerated.
Just seems like there's a massive amount of mud throwing, really. We've got Piquet going. Alonso knew, he knew, and why is Piquet Senior even involved in this? He's fine. He's Nelsino's father, great, but you know, he's got no right, quite frankly, to go up to Alonso and say you're lying, because it's essentially that's what he's done. It just seems like Max and Piquet are out to get Flavio, which is fine if they want to do that. I don't particularly like Flavio anyway, but can they just do it in some other way that doesn't involve the entire F1 team?
I think as you mentioned, if this was another, if this is a proper legal system and this is a criminal matter, then the case would have been thrown out after the prosecution's documents were leaked. I think the fact that those documents were leaked demonstrates two things. Firstly, that Renault are in a bit more trouble than certainly I initially thought. The telemetry readings don't make for pretty reading for people who would like to see Renault get off lightly. But secondly, it demonstrates, I think, the will of the PKs and the prosecution, and that is to damage Renault as much as possible. The fact that it was leaked, for me, demonstrates that what they want to do is to ruin Renault and to rub their names through the dirt. And I'm just amazed that someone can be so bitter that they would be willing to take down an entire F1 team and all their employees.
What I think a lot of people in the Formula One world, and certainly a lot of the fans, forget is that it's not just, a case of Flavio Briatore and Pat Simmons and the PKs. People's jobs are on the line here, A lot of people work, it's a livelihood, and it's now under threat. I mean, whatever happens on Monday, Renault could pull out, and that's terrible. Certainly the amount of information that has been leaked, it would point to, a witch hunt against Flavio Briatore, because they have offered Pat Simmons immunity, and they haven't offered Flavio Briatore immunity. So that certainly shows that somebody's out there, they want his head, and I think it's more than the PKs, but that's my opinion. But we'll see what happens on Monday, of course. A lot of people's minds have already been made up by, the amount of information that has come out in the last week. Renault haven't had their chance to give their evidence to the FIA. The defence case has been completely ruined by these allegations, and I think it's disgusting that it's been played out in this manner, and I hope Formula One will learn from it. I said this when the Spygate happened in 2007.
I think the problem with it really is, it just, even with all the telemetry and all the, evidence, like Pat or being unwilling to admit anything to the FIA when investigated. It does just seem a bit weird that Nelson Piquet would actually consider crashing at the speed he crashed just to help Alonso out. I find it very hard to believe just on that ground. And Piquet Senior is a bit of a dodgy character. Of all the stuff he said to Mansell when he raced there, and just acted like.
Would you say that Nelson Piquet Junior is now unemployable in Formula One?
Definitely.
Yep.
Well, time will tell what will happen to Renault, and hopefully, anyways, we'll be able to bring you our views and our reaction to the news whenever it breaks next Monday or Tuesday, be it. There will be many things to talk about in the build-up to the Singapore Grand Prix. So let's move on, and let's talk about some other news which has just broke. And it's the FIA again. They're again involved in this, but they have announced that BMW Sauber will not be given the final grid place for next season. It has went to a Malaysian-backed Lotus team. Yes, Lotus, the mark, the famous mark, is returning to Formula 1 for the first time since 1994. Although BMW were able to find a buyer in the form of a Swiss consortium, they've only been given the 14th place in the grid, which is a reserve place in case one of the teams decide to pull out, maybe Renault, maybe Toyota, we don't know. But certainly, gentlemen, what is your reaction to the news that Lotus is back in Formula One, and is it really Lotus?
It's like a fake Lotus, isn't it, at the end of the day? It's a Malaysian, it's basically a Proton and a Malaysian government running our cars with a Lotus badge on. They're not going to get very far though with Proton badges on the front, because everyone's going to go Proton with A. In Europe anyway. I think it's a bit plastic Lotus. It's not real, and I don't think Chapman would be happy about this if he's still alive today.
I think it's almost the same thing as we had when Jaguar had their F1 team. It was basically a corporate exercise by Ford, who wanted to get into motorsport one way or another, and Jaguar weren't really allowed to perform with the freedom that a Formula One race team needs to, because of the corporate element. involved in the running of the team, and I think it's going to be a struggle for Lotus as a race team next season to emerge from the shackles of the kind of the corporate system of Proton and the Malaysian government, because, you know, even with the best intentions in the world, they're still not going to know how to run a race team, and I think it's going to be a similar story.
Well, after a year out, well, nearly a year, Mike Gascoigne returns to Formula One in the shape, or the form, sorry, of technical director from Lotus, and he says that the team's aim is to be the best of the new teams, so that's your Campos, that's your USF1, etc., etc., etc. But, you know, have they left it a little bit too late? Can Lotus really dream of being able to better the likes of Mana and the likes of USF1, who have had almost a head start on developing their car?
Right.
Well, Gascoigne is a very knowledgeable chap. He really impressed me when he was commentating for the BBC in replacing Eddie. That was probably the best show that BBC did, you know, without Eddie being there, that is. So, you know, he seems like a knowledgeable bloke. He was able to look at the cars and go, that's how it works. So, you know, it's hard to say, really. I mean, hopefully, he's got a realistic aim. He's not coming in and saying, we're going to be the best team ever. You know, he's going to be... I think, like I said, I read an article which interviewed him about him being kicked out of Toyota, and he said he wasn't given enough time, and they wouldn't really listen to him, and there was too much corporate stuff back at Toyota. And then at Force India, the same thing, really. So, you know, he's obviously doing something a bit wrong, you know, if he's being kicked out. But if he's got the team under his control and people do as he say, and he's allowed to, you know, try ideas and stuff, I can't see why it won't work. And, you know, I hope it does, because I like the guy. He seems like a bit of a character.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, he's got a bit of a mixed sort of track record. But I think in terms of their aim of being... the best of the newcomers, certainly with him on board, with the experience that he has, and he's, you know, he's a risk taker, which is what they need. They do stand a decent chance, I'd say, of being the best out of the newcomers. I certainly don't rate USF1 or Mana or Campos's chances that highly in terms of threatening the established F1 team. So it's not a particularly high bar I think they're going to have to aim for, Lotus. But you know, at the start of the season, as Ewan said, they are going to be behind. In terms of the preparations that the other newcomers are going to have made, so maybe it's something they need to aim for you know, towards the end of the season rather than, you know, initially.
I heard the USF1 car still confused by right hand bends though.
Oh, well, we have to apologise on behalf of Gaz to all you American listeners out there, unless you aren't offended and, you know, you're not a NASCAR fan. Or an IRL
I'm only
fan.
Joking.
let's talk about BMW very quickly. Now, they finally had their future secured, but they're only on the reserve list unless the FIA can get the teams to commit to 14 teams next year to 28 cars. Now, a lot of teams might back this proposal, but you look around the Formula One calendar and you look at the places we go to, you know, the Monacos, the Valencias. You know, Canada's coming back on the calendar. You know, these places, I don't think, have the capacity to hold 14 teams. I mean, there was always going to be a struggle with the three new teams, but if they were going to have, you know, a fourth one, if BMW are allowed in, then do you think there's room for them?
On the grid, definitely. You know, on the track and the grid, yeah. Because, you know, especially next year when the teams begin to spread out a bit more as the new teams understand the 09 rules or the 09 010 hybrid rules. I think the only problem is the garage slots, especially some of the old tracks. There's limited space, but you know, if they can budge them up a bit and, you know, squeeze them in, yeah, definitely I'd like to see another team on the grid, if even to give a bit more of a bit of a safety gap if another team leaves.
I think there's a couple of issues with that, 28 car grid. Firstly, the teams have got to agree, and we've got to look at what agendas are flying around the paddock at the moment. Ferrari seem to want a three car team for next season, and having an extra team in Formula One is going to, I guess, decrease the chances of that happening. But putting that to one side, purely from a garage space point of view, I think it's going to be a matter of of whether the new teams coming into F1 are willing to have some slightly inferior garage facilities. And I think on the face of it, you know, based on the fact that there's going to be, you know, at least half the tracks that F1 visits are going to be able to cope with that, they would rather have poor garage facilities for a year or two rather than not be in F1 at all. So I think if the teams in question have any say, I'm sure they wouldn't have a problem with putting up with some slightly inferior facilities just so they could compete.
Indeed, and I think that just about wraps up this. You like pickled eggs too. From all of us here, this was a Grand Prix cast brought to you by ForumEla1.net. Good night.